every once in a while, like when you get to be 700, you should pause and celebrate by doing something special. And so today, on the 700th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show, we are going to do something very special. We are going to make host Michael Olson our guest and ask him, can we eat our way to economic security and personal freedom?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned in to the 700th edition of the Food Chain, right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Portofino, who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are, and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Marlene Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, how's it going?
Pretty good. How
good,
are you?
Good. Good to have two girls doing it.
Yeah. But guess what? When you've been around the block a few times, you tend to get a notion of how things work. When it comes to food and agriculture, Michael Olson has been around the block a few times with his Metro Farm book and his Food Chain Radio show. That's 700 times to be exact. Wow, Michael. But we never really get to hear what Michael Olson thinks, because mostly we hear him asking questions about what other people think. So today, we are going to make him the guest of the Food Chain Radio Show and ask him this question. Michael, can we eat our way to economic security and personal freedom?
Yes, we can, Marlene, and we can do it so easily, it's going to make you blush. And we can do it without politicians, we can do it without taxes, we can do it without armies, and we can do it with each other. And it won't cost us a lot of money. And like I said, it's going to be so easy that it will make you blush.
Okay.
Hey, before we go on, I think we should introduce you. Folks, you've heard me for a long time, but this new voice you're hearing is my wife, Marlene. Marlene and I met about 37 years ago on a blind date in Billings, Montana. And we eloped on an Amtrak train, and we've been running together ever since. So if you detect a little familiarity, that's why. Fire away, Kit.
Okay. So we'll try to get right to the questions again here. Can you explain how we can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom? I guess what we really need to do is we need to ask a little bit more about you, Michael.
Sure. Fire away.
So you have a degree, but it's not in agriculture. What the heck is it?
Well, you know, if I had a degree in agriculture, I wouldn't be here, I don't think. I would probably be in production agriculture somehow, somewhere, and I am not. I mean, a whole different world. So my education in agriculture is really the education of a lifetime, and probably starts way back on my grandparents' farm in the little town of Belfry, Montana.
So you were raised on a farm?
Mostly. My parents were more than happy to get rid of me and shunt me off to the grandparents' farm most of the summers, and I spent my winters in town going to school. But the farm was really, you know, where I think kind of emerged as a person, you know, because they thrust responsibility on you at a very early age on the farm. And my grandparents' farm was 360 irrigated acres. And he had just about everything in the world you could imagine growing there, including all the animals of the classic barnyard. And so there was always chores. There was always machines to fix and to drive. And there were always animals to work with. And there was always chores. And from that, I believe, I really took a great joy in the adventure of chores and learned what an incredibly diverse place the farm is, and how you have to have this real broad body of knowledge to be able to be a good farmer.
One of your favorite lines is that you claim to be a teenage herbicide.
Yes, a teenager herbicide. Well, in my teenage years, I spent a lot of my working time. I could always find jobs on farms and ranches. And it was kind of very much like the contemporary field worker you see out here in the Pajaro and Salinas Valleys. I was one of the guys that was walking up and down the row with a hoe, weeding the beet fields and bean fields and whatnot. And I spent a lot of time out there in the fields earning money. That's what you did when you were a kid and growing up in Montana, is you had to work, unless you had parents that gave you money, and mine didn't. So yeah. There I was out there in the field working. And the interesting thing about working out there in those fields of Montana was that the air was so clear and so dry that you could see great distances through the sky. They call it the big sky country. And I used to spend a lot of time with my eyes up in the air watching those jets fly over and wondering where they were going. The air was so clear that you could see which company was flying those jets by the paint scheme at 35,000 feet. You could see, there goes a Northwest Airlines jet. I wonder if he is flying to the Orient, you know. And I guess I spent too much time with my head up there watching those airplanes and developed a great desire to do some traveling myself.
And you became a pilot, and then shortly after becoming a pilot, you decided you're going to join the Navy. Tell us, what did the Navy ever teach you about agriculture?
Pretty good one, huh? Well, I didn't decide to join the Navy. I had to join something really fast, or they were going to ship me overseas one way or another. So I had a high school civics teacher that was a wonderful storyteller, and he was also a Navy recruiter. So when I learned that I was going to be shipped overseas, I went down and talked with him, and he signed me up in the Navy program, and away I went. And next thing I knew, I was a Montana boy on a ship that was cruising around Asia. And this is kind of interesting what the Navy taught me about agriculture, is that when our ship would pull into a port in like Japan or something, you know, the sailors would typically, you know, roll off the ship and into a bar, and that's where a lot of them would stay for a significant amount of time. Well, it didn't take me too long to get bored with that kind of stuff. So I took to traveling about the countryside whenever I could, mostly on bicycles. Just get a bicycle and ride out and see where serendipity took me. But where it took me was through some of the most incredible agriculture I've ever seen, whereas my grandfather had 360 acres of irrigated land, these Japanese farmers only had like two or three or maybe even a half acre.
So small scale.
So the intensity with which they worked those small parcels of land was truly a sight to behold. And as a child of the big sky country of Montana, you know, where the space is unlimited, I was truly amazed at what they could do with so little. And if you look at the population of the West Coast, so many of those Asian farmers who did not have much in Japan or China or whatnot came to the United States and saw all of this incredible opportunity in these small farms around here and truly became very successful. The Tanimiras of the Salinas Valley, for example, the Chino family of Rancho Santa Fe,
right,
and on and on and on. Those folks looked at this incredible space that we have available and thought, my goodness, look at this opportunity. And so that really struck me as a Montana boy. It was just a wonderful juxtaposition to come from a place where space was everywhere, you know.
In fact, one of your photos of Japan is actually in the book Metro Farm. Made it all the way back.
Made it all the way back with me. Yeah, isn't that amazing?
It is. So you do have a degree, not in agriculture, but in English and Chinese literature. I remember when we first met and you came back to California and I was still in Montana, you wrote love letters in Chinese calligraphy. Uh-huh. Of course, I couldn't read them, but...
Then how do you know they were love letters?
I don't know.
Yeah.
So tell me, what about Chinese and English literature? What does that have to do with egg?
Wow. Okay. Well, we're going to take a break here in a minute, but maybe I can get started on this story because it's a significant story. To learn Chinese, Mandarin Chinese, here in the United States was quite a task because very, very few people spoke or speak today Mandarin. Most of them speak Cantonese, and so when learning Mandarin, I was kind of all by myself, thus precipitating the need to spend a lot of time in the language lab. And so we'll pick it up,
the
story, when we come back from the break.
Thank you, Michael. So, folks, it's time to take a quick break. And when we return, we'll talk more about the question, can we eat our way to economic security and personal freedom?
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back. Hey, folks, what do you think about this question? Can we eat our way to economic security and personal freedom? Michael Olson thinks so, and he's our guest today in the studio. Michael, what the heck does Chinese literature have to do with agriculture?
Well, who knows, but I certainly didn't think it had anything to do with agriculture when I was taking and studying Chinese literature and Chinese language. But as I was saying, to learn the language, I had to spend an inordinate amount of time in the language lab up at University of California, Santa Cruz. And while there, right next door, you know, I would spend all of this time in this dark studio with listening to tapes of Chinese speaking over and over and over. But right outside the language lab, there was a beautiful little garden put together by an Englishman named Alan Chadwick. And in this garden on a steep hill of unusable land, they built this little fairy garden kingdom. And I would stumble out of that dark, stupid language lab and into the sunshine and look across the way there, and there would be all these pretty girls digging in the dirt in the Chadwick garden. And of course, where there were pretty girls digging in the dirt, there were lots of guys too. And there was just this garden was just absolutely full of life and happiness and frivolity and laughter and gaiety. And here I was in the language lab and thinking, what the heck am I doing wrong here, you know? And it really struck me that these people were in love with the earth and plants and growing things. And, of course, Alan Chadwick would eventually get kicked out of the University of California, Santa Cruz, for the simple reason that these kids who were so in love with his teachings and his gardening would call home to their parents and say, "Mom, Dad, I'm going to be an organic farmer." And, of course, Mom and Dad would go, "You're what?" And they would call the president of the University of California, Santa Cruz, and say, "What the heck are you doing with my kid? I'm spending all this money to have them become an electrical engineer, and they're calling home and telling us they want to be an organic farmer. This is crazy."
Yeah.
But it really taught me that there was a love, first of all, that there was a tremendous love for growing and for being in touch with the earth. And these kids were mostly, you know, from Los Angeles and had lost that. And so they were becoming reacquainted with growing things, and it was just magic on them. It was like sprinkling fairy dust on their heads or something, and they just became animated as all heck.
So, Alan Chadwick, and then you graduated with a degree in Chinese and English literature, mm-hmm. and then I know this because I was with you at the time. Off we went to NBC Magazine and David Brinkley.
Mm-hmm.
And what did that teach you about agriculture?
Well, our job, as you well know, Marlene, was to find stories for NBC Magazine with David Brinkley and develop them and put them on the air. And one of the pieces that we did was up in the Rogue Valley of Southern Oregon, and it was a piece on survivalists. Survivalists are those people who believe that the city... the economies of cities are going to collapse. Now, where they got that idea, I have no idea. But they believe that the cities are going to collapse. So they move more than one gas tank away from the big cities and hunker down and wait for Armageddon. That was the survivalist story. And, of course, Rogue River, Oregon, Medford, Oregon, Grants Pass, Oregon, is roughly equidistant between Portland and San Francisco and more than one gas tank away from each city. So ideal survivalist retreat. So when we were doing this piece on survivalists, our guide was a gal named Nancy Mack Tappan, and we were standing on a hill overlooking the Rogue Valley of Southern Oregon. And what was doing an establishing shot. You know, we had our talent and we had the camera crew and the talent was saying, you know, beyond you could see the Rogue Valley of Southern Oregon, this is where the survivalists hang out. And when you look down into the valley, you saw all of these beautiful little ranchettes, beautiful little mini farms, but nobody was growing anything. And it just struck me, you know, being from a Montana farm and that kind of background and seeing what people did with small farms in Japan and seeing what the Chadwick people had done with their small parcel. And I just turned to Nancy and I said, Nancy, we should do a pamphlet on ways to make money with those small parcels of land. And didn't think much more about it, you know, a flip here. What do you think about that? And she said, Michael, that's a wonderful idea. And so a month later, we got a call from Nancy, and Nancy says, Michael, we sold your book. And thus began the adventure of Metro Farm.
And so on from NBC Magazine and working with them for a few years, and then this phone call from Nancy, and then, whoops, we better write a book. So it wasn't just a pamphlet. It was a book, huge book.
Well, I think what really fascinated me was the fact that... When I went to the census, I had to find out where people make money with small parcels of land. And I went to the Census of Agriculture, and what I learned was that whereas the average acre of farmland in the state of Iowa makes $300 per acre per year, the average acre of farmland in the city limits of San Francisco was making upwards of $80,000 per acre per year. And thus began the search for how that works. How do people make up to $80,000 per acre per year on an acre of land? How does this work? And so this brought me into a whole new realm of agriculture. And in the compilation of putting together Metro Farm, I realized that, or at least from my perspective, I see industry growing in two directions, very, very big and very, very small. And it seems like everything in the middle is like roadkill these days. And so when you go around your town or my town or any town, what you see are a few very big stores and a few very small stores. And everything in the middle has kind of disappeared. So the question becomes, how do you compete in this milieu, this marketplace, and win, especially if you're a small farmer? And so Metro Farm really became a guide to the competition for the consumer dollars. And in that regard, it resembles much more Sun Tzu's Art of War than it does Robert Rodale's Organic Gardening, much to the chagrin of many of the people that I give seminars to. They always want to see themselves as being organic gardeners and being able to go out into the countryside and grow their petunias, and their petunias are going to be so beautiful and so organic that people will flock to them, and they won't have to compete, and they'll just be live happily ever after. But in all reality, this is competition.
So it's not this bucolic kind of peaceful back to the earth kind of movement, but you see it really as competition, and from your Chinese training, war.
It is war. It is the art of the war for the marketplace and how you compete. And if you're small, how on earth do you compete with somebody who's big and win? And that's what Metro Farm is really all about. How you go out and with your small parcel of land. And if you have an acre of tomatoes, how are you going to compete with somebody who has 10,000 acres of tomatoes?
So, Michael, you've done 699 episodes of the Food Chain Radio Show. And what has this taught you about food and agriculture?
Well, that's pretty interesting. You know, when you do 700 of something, you kind of see the comings and goings. So what
it's
I've
almost 14 years.
So what I've distilled what I have seen into three laws. First, Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. No surplus of food, no sandcastles. Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. And Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
Wow. Yeah.
I hear the music.
I hear the music, too. I suppose I'm supposed to say something like,
stay tuned.
Folks, stay tuned. Come back and join Michael Olson and myself, Marlene Olson. We're going to be talking more about Michael's recent presentation, Let's Eat Our Way to Economic Security and Personal Freedom. What do you think, folks? Join us. Bye-bye. Welcome back. We're here with Michael Olson as our guest.
Hey, that's me.
And I'm Marlene Olson. Today we're asking, what is the relationship of food and freedom, Michael?
I did a piece recently for an organization. I don't know who they were. They call themselves the Freedom Forum. And they asked me to make a presentation. So I said, well, Freedom Forum, okay, I'll just do something like From Food to Freedom. And where does that get me? I started thinking about what is the relationship from food to freedom. And looking back on our travels, Marlene, and the experiences that we've had, and I started thinking about the relationship of food to civilization and the places that we've been who have really amplified that for me, at least in my mind. And first example, of course, is the Nile Delta and its relationship to Cairo and to the pyramid and to the power of the Egyptian civilization that it brought. And of course, the Nile Delta is one of the most fecund places on Earth. You know, you just throw seeds out there and you have food. And the power of that agriculture was really the foundation upon which they built the Egyptian civilization. And, of course, from that civilization, we have all kinds of relics like pyramids and sphinxes and this and that and this and that. And we look at what energy it must have took to build those edifices.
Those sandcastles,
exactly right. And then, you know, the same can be seen in the great Urubamba River Valley of Peru, which was the heart of the homeland of the Inca civilization. And the power of the agriculture there also spawned this great civilization. And, of course, from that, they piled up a lot of rocks themselves with Machu Picchu and Sacsayhuaman and all of these great rock formations that the Incas built, too, just like the Egyptians. And so you look at those powerful civilizations, and they were all made possible by the abundance of food. And another thing that really struck me in the course of our travels with the food chain was a couple of shows that we did called Crime and Nourishment with Dr. Steven Schoenthaler, who's a criminologist that studied nutrient content of food and criminal behavior. And he went into prisons and got the wardens to work with him, and he removed all of the junk food and divided the prison population up into two groups. One group received a plain old multivitamin, and the other group a sugar pill. And from these two groups, he measured criminal behavior and realized that it was able to document that the group with a sugar pill had no change in their criminal behavior. But the group that had the plain old multivitamin committed 40% less violent crimes. 40%.
That's
and
amazing.
He was able to duplicate the study across the country. So here you have really two great indications of the importance of food to freedom. If you have enough food, and if your food is nutritious, you have freedom. And if you have no food, or if you're relying on somebody else for your food, then you're not free.
Mm.
So that's what I think.
So tell me, what does government play in our food chain?
What role does government play?
Yeah.
Well, I guess we're putting this question on the table as a consequence of our last three shows here on the food chain, in which we examined, we called it the gods at damn food. But this story was really about food safety and the government's role in the food safety crisis we're having here in the United States. And the first question we have to ask is, which food is in crisis? And, you know, we're talking about this competition, this basic competition between very small growers and very big growers. And that's what Metro Farm is all about, is how small farmers can go up against big farmers and win the competition for the consumer dollar. So when we look at and see what kind of food is really in crisis here in the United States, and we do have a food safety crisis because we're eating food that's putting it at risk, and we're getting sick, and it's
many
happening.
People are getting sick, aren't they?
Yeah, it's 76 million a year get sick from food poisoning, okay?
Ooh.
But when we look at and see at what food is in trouble, what we find is that it's food from industrial sources that come from a long ways away because we have very little control over that food. And when we have no control over that food, we really don't know what's in it. And they have to do things to it that, you know, if you grow your own broccoli in your own backyard, you have total control over that food, or at least as far as the kind of control that nature allows you to have. But if you buy organic broccoli at the farmer's market, you have some control too, because you can look in that farmer's eye and see what's in the garlic or in the broccoli. And similarly, if you buy that food from a local store, you have control too, because you can look in the grocer's eye and say, are you protecting me? But what if that organic broccoli is coming from China? How much control do you have over that? You have very little control.
So, Michael, you recently talked about the big box store's organic broccoli, and mm-hmm. you said it came all the way from China?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And the way that works is that there's an organic broccoli from China. The way it works is that there's a certification agency in Nebraska that hires members of the Chinese government to go out into the countryside and certify that the produce is indeed United States Department of Agriculture certified organic.
So the chances of it being organic...
Or who knows?
Who knows?
You have no control because of the distance.
Right. And so...
Which food is in trouble? Food is in crisis? It tends to be the industrial food that comes from a long ways away. Okay.
Or from the plants, like the peanut butter, for instance, was not mm-hmm. really the peanuts that were growing in the fields.
No, of course not. It comes from the processing plant.
And
that's where most
eggs.
Problems comes from, yeah. That's where most problem comes from. So now the government steps into this situation and says we have to make food safe. But who is the government making food safe for here? Is it making food safe for consumers, or is it making food safe for producers? If you look at some of the legislation being passed, like Senate Bill 510, you come to the conclusion that the rules are so onerous that only giant industrial firms will have the economies of scale sufficient to grow food for us.
So employees that are paid to fill out all the forms and keep up with all the government
attorneys,
criteria.
All the forms, all the reporting, all the processing, all of the inspections, all of the this and all of that and all of that will be required of everybody, right? So whether you are actually having trouble or not has no difference. So the people who are growing broccoli for you down the street and selling it to you at the farmer's market are going to have to adopt the same safety procedures as those people who are growing broccoli in where, who knows where.
They don't have it budgeted for that kind of bureaucracy within their own business plan.
Right.
How could they possibly do this?
So here we have an interesting situation in competition for the government, because the government sets the rules. On one side of this competition, you have the large industrial firms that benefit from the economies of scale. They have the money to donate. On the other side, you have the small farmers who don't have the money, but in the aggregate have the votes. Mm-hmm. And here is the competition we'll pick up after we get back from this break.
And so, folks, join us. Can we eat our way to economic security and personal freedom? Hello, folks. Today we are with our guest, Michael Olson, in the studios. And the question is, can we eat our way to economic security and personal freedom?
Well, who are you?
And I am Marlene Olson, your host for today. Michael, what role does the government play in this?
To finish this up, we have a competition for the government is going to decide how food safety is going to work. And so we have a competition to work with government to make sure that the rules benefit you and get rid of your competition. So the two sides of this are those who are very, very big and those are very, very small.
So, Michael, is the competition, and we talked about competition earlier in the show, between the very big and the very small actually a competition? I mean, what are the big guys worried about?
Everything.
Really?
Farmers markets, the proliferation of local food. Terribly frightening to them.
Why is that?
Because they work on thin margins, and when people go to the farmer's market and buy food, that margin gets thinner and thinner and thinner. So both sides are petitioning the federal government to make sure that they can survive whatever kind of rules the government sets. Now, who's winning this war for the government's attention, I believe, are the big people. Why do I believe that? Because the person who has been appointed food safety czar for the United States of America is none other than Michael Taylor, the former vice president of the Monsanto Corporation. That's why
who appointed him?
President Obama.
Whoa.
Should we gotta go to the phones? We have callers. Holy smokes. Let's go and talk with Peter. Go ahead.
Hello, Peter. This is Marlene Olson, and our guest is Michael Olson. What's your question today?
Good morning, Marlene and Michael. Oh, I just wanted to contribute that I'm just going out there and turning my compost pile as a way to eat and work your way to personal freedom from the big chain grocery industry.
Good for you. So I guess you don't shop at a big box.
No. I go to our little stores if I need something. But just with a little garden, I find you can grow a lot of vegetables, but that's what Mike was saying, you know, that's just amazing.
And when you have those vegetables and when you have that food, you're free.
Right. And they taste different. Yeah.
It hasn't traveled 2,000 miles, right?
Exactly.
Thank you, Peter, for your call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. So, Michael, I have a question.
Well, we have
you.
Somebody else here, Michael.
Okay.
Let's try Billy. Willie?
Hello, how are you?
Billy.
Yes.
Hi, Billy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question today?
I have a question for Michael. Both Michael and I grew up on family farms and in farming rural America. My question for you is, do you see anybody else having that opportunity that we had growing up on a small or large farm and learning about agriculture by doing it as a child?
You know, Billy, I think it's the greatest tragedy of industrializing agriculture is that we've taken our children off the farm and put them on the street corners where they have nothing to do but get into trouble. And you know what, we were, you know, and I know, and Nikki James in there knows too, that when you grow up in agriculture, you grow up doing so many different things that your mind just expands, and you're learning how to use equipment, you're learning how to treat animals, you're learning how to grow plants. It's a tremendously beneficial educational opportunity for young people. And beyond all, you're learning the joy of working, learning how to work.
And that's something, you mentioned that sort of in passing, but that's sort of at the root of my question. We have lost, at least I think, we have lost a generation that didn't grow up learning the joys of working.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, Billy, this is a good lead-in to the next question here that I have, and that is, can we eat our way to economic security and personal freedom by supporting farmers? Is there something we can do to get to that?
There is something we can do. Let's bring Billy along with this one. He'll make a good sounding board on this one. I maintain that we can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. And it's going to be so easy, it's going to make everybody blush. And here's the only two things that we have to do is, and I call this the 2x2 pledge, by the way. Thing number one, the first thing we have to do is pledge to spend $2 per day on local foods. Now, that shouldn't be hard. That's less than a cup of coffee at the restaurant or an energy drink or anything. It's $2 a day on local foods, okay? The second thing that we have to do is convince two other people to do the same thing. Now, let's follow this out here for a moment. Let's say in our market, as you know, Billy, there's 500,000 people.
Right.
Right? If each one of us were to spend $2 per day, that would be $1 million per day or $365 million per year. Now, each one of those dollars doesn't just go around once. It goes around at least seven times. Thus, that $2 a day would equal about $2.5 billion a year in local money. Now, if that sounds extraordinary, I'm involved in an organization called Think Local First. We passed out five $100 checks. Those checks had to be spent only at local businesses for a month. Those five $100 checks in 30 days generated $6,900 worth of local business. That's local money.
It's a real thing.
So when we come back from this break,
we're going to continue our discussion with our guest, Michael Olson, and Billy. Can you hang on, Billy?
Sure.
Okay, good. And we're going to talk about, can we eat our way to economic security and personal freedom? Welcome back, folks. We're talking with our guest, Michael Olson. Can we eat our way to economic security and personal freedom? Michael, what role does this campaign have for us, this pledge, this 2x2 pledge?
Okay. Also have Billy there. Billy,
yeah,
what is it?
Billy, welcome back.
Thank you.
Billy, so we have an idea here. First of all, we pledge to spend $2 per day on local food. That makes sense to you?
It does, because it's basic mathematics. If you just extrapolate out as you did before the break.
Let's continue that extrapolation. So we each spend $2 per day on local food. There are 500,000 of us in this market. That's $1 million a day. $365 million a year. Ladies and gentlemen, that's enough to support 1,000 farmers earning $365,000 per year.
Well, we talk about economic stimulus. You know, we talk about our government taking care of us. This is a really good way for us to take care of us.
Take care of ourselves. With 1,000 farmers earning a third of $1 million a year, that would support a whole population of butchers and bakers and candlestick makers. And think of the green jobs, folks. These are real green jobs. These are green jobs where you take carbon dioxide and you turn it into oxygen and you make food with it. Wow, that's so much better than the green jobs where you lubricate somebody else's windmills.
And, Michael, it goes back to what you were talking about earlier in the program where you came out of the language lab up at UC and you saw those fine young people working with Alan Chadwick in the garden. Well, this is a chance to put some of those people to real work.
Put them to real work and good work and valuable work, growing real food for all of us, all on $2 a day. But think about this. Let's play with this, and let's say that on that $2 worth of food every day, we start to get a taste of what real food is like again.
And it does taste different.
And it does taste different, and it is different.
And it's healthier. It's better for you.
And so we start to enjoy this food. And so instead of $2 a day, we just like are spending $10 a day. Gosh, that would be $5 million a day. $1.82 billion a year. 12.7 folks. We can grow our way to economic security. Imagine having 1,000 farmers in our little neighborhood, each of which is earning $250,000 a year.
And it opens up a whole other kind of commerce as well, which you haven't even touched on, which is, you know, if your neighbor grows really great tomatoes, but you're not so good at it, but you grow really good apples.
There you go.
That's a whole other economy
A whole other economy.
And you know, what interests me is that, gosh, we wouldn't have to add a whole other layer of bureaucrats into monitoring our food, which they don't do a good job
of
anyway.
We don't need the politicians.
How many of us are sick every year?
See, once this takes off, the politicians will have to get out of the way. Rich, what do you think?
Well, you know, I had two questions for you, Michael. I think, yeah, we need to take control of our lives on this, and SB 510 is trying to wrestle our control away to the government, because I think ultimately this is population control through food control, just like we're dealing with the banks.
And when you don't have control of your food, you're not free.
Right. I asked Dr. Wallach, I said, what do you think of SB 510 passes? And he says the people will not put up with it. I don't know what your version is.
Here's how we don't put up with it, Rich. We take the 2x2 pledge. Every one of us takes the pledge. You can go to metrofarm.com, click on the 2x2 pledge, take it. We'll all spend $2 per day on local food, and we'll all talk two others to doing it, and we will be free, and we will be economically secure.
And, Michael, do you have a garden, and what do you grow?
I have a whole herd of fruit trees. They're beautiful. They're my babies. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. And
thank you, Billy.
Go to metrofarm.com, sign up on the 2x2 campaign, and join us to economic freedom through our food.
And personal freedom. Thank you, Marlene.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.